This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson. I'll be speaking today to two journalists, one from Gaza, another who's lived there, about the war in Gaza and the background to it. First, news. As of October 25th, the Committee to Protect Journalists reported at least 24 journalists among the 7,000 dead on both sides of the Israel-Hamas war. That number includes 20 Palestinian journalists, 3 Israeli journalists, reporters, and 1 Lebanese journalist. In addition to those killed, 8 journalists have been wounded, 3 reported missing or detained. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has long been a difficult environment for journalists. In 2022, a legal complaint was submitted to the International Criminal Court by the International Federation of Journalists and the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate, charging Israel with the systematic targeting of journalists in Palestine. Since October 7th, the Committee to Protect Journalists reports journalists are experiencing assaults, arrests, threats, cyber attacks, and censorship in Israel and the West Bank. On October 16th, Israel proposed new emergency regulations that would allow it to halt media broadcasts that harm, quote, national morale, end quote. Officials have threatened to close Al Jazeera's local offices under this proposed rule and to block the global news outlet from freely reporting on the war. Challenging as the circumstances are for journalists in Israel and the West Bank, the gravest danger to journalists is in Gaza, where more Palestinian journalists have been killed in the last 2.5 weeks than in all the years since 2001. The Washington Post published an article October 16th with the headline, "It's Becoming Impossible to Report from Gaza." The Post reports that the scale of the Israeli assault in Gaza means that reporters are facing unprecedented risks. They are contending with a massive bombing campaign, electrical and internet outages, food and water shortages, and the challenges of reporting on the unfolding humanitarian crises while living it themselves. With outside journalists unable to enter Gaza since the Hamas attack October 7th, and so many journalists inside Gaza dying, some Palestinians on the ground are seeking new ways to document what is happening. One such venture is the collaboration between U.S. independent film producer and director Maurice Jacobson and The Media Group, a production company in Gaza he has worked with for more than a decade. The Media Group's studios, editing facilities, office, and much of their production equipment have been destroyed in the bombing, but they are sending out video through WhatsApp to document what is happening on the ground. Here to tell us more about that is Maurice Jacobson. He has been working in the Middle East since 2002 and has done extensive work in and about Gaza, directing and producing video projects for the humanitarian aid NGOs Oxfam and Mercy Corps, 2 documentaries commissioned by Press TV called Shelled and Encircled that have aired internationally, and a feature-length documentary called We All Live in Gaza. Maurice Jacobson, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine. Maurice, you've been working with a team in Gaza for a long time. You're still working with Rami and Atif and their team members, putting out short film segments called We All Live in Gaza, The War Chronicles. Tell us about this and what together you all are trying to do.
One of the things that is so sadly missing in most of the media coverage, and you don't even know what to call it, whether to call it a war or a struggle or a massacre. It's almost like we need a new word to describe what's going on. But the background, why this terrible situation is happening, is hardly being covered whatsoever. The fact that Gaza had been under siege and occupation for over 14 years, and that there was not one young person in Gaza who wasn't affected by losing a family member or a friend or having property destroyed. I, over the years, have been amazed how resilient people were of getting beyond that. But at the same time, there obviously were a group of young people who were getting angrier by the moment. the organization Hamas really saw themselves and still see themselves, obviously, as a resistance organization, a resistance against the siege and occupation and struggling for dignity and basic human rights. Knowing I understand what was probably going through the minds of those young people who entered Israel and did mass killing, having an emotional sense that as they were pulling triggers, they were saying, this is for my mother, or this is for my best friend. And it was pure revenge. It's such a sad situation. And now we're seeing the reverse in steroids. But the motivation, to go back to the basic question that you asked, was just to try to fill in the gaps of why this happened in the first place, why this conflict began, and why it's escalated to this terrible, nightmarish point that it is now.
One of the things that you've done in the two episodes of the War Chronicles that I have seen is you've paired footage of Gaza before this most recent bombing with what's going on now. And so it gives the viewer a sense of context about what normal life in Gaza was like. And of course, normal life in Gaza probably has to be put in quotation marks because of the siege. I think it works really well. Talk to us about the dangers that your team members in Gaza are experiencing.
It's the worst possible nightmare you could think of. They started working in a temporary office that they had, and that was attacked, and they had to flee. The last WhatsApp, without any video, unfortunately, because they have absolutely no internet. I'm not even sure how Rami was able to send on WhatsApp, saying that they were safe. He and his family, extended family, of 47 people have said they've had to move six times. Right now, they're in a small house somewhere on the coast. They kind of didn't want to put on the internet where it was. They say that they're running out of everything, food, fuel, anything you need for basic survival. And so the siege, if it's not lifted entirely or some other mechanism put in place, not only Rami and his father and all his kids, Rami has three young kids, they're all going to face starvation. There's no other way to say it. It feels like a real genocide in progress. So if people aren't killed through a bombing, they could slowly pass away by not having food or water. That's an extreme thing to say, and it probably won't happen. But right now, the last WhatsApp message that I got from Rami yesterday was a short message saying, no food, no fuel, we're in desperate situation.
Maurice, you spent 16 months living and working in the Gaza Strip while you did the filming for We All Live in Gaza, which you've said is actually still in post-production, has not yet been aired. What led you to go to the Gaza Strip?
It's a long story. It first started with a project that I was doing with public television, a project called Jerusalem, A Living History. And I spent a lot of time in Jerusalem, and we had two translators there, a Palestinian translator and an Israeli translator. And I got to be good friends with Khalil, the Palestinian translator, who took me after the production was over throughout the West Bank to meet his family and to give me a better sense about what life was like on the West Bank. And I realized at that point as a journalist that the story absolutely wasn't being told, that the Palestinian perspective was completely being depressed in mainstream media. So I tried the best I could to tell the story from the Palestinian perspective. And then when Operation Cast Lead happened in 2009, I just felt compelled to go to Gaza. I didn't go on those first trips. And so I did a crowdsourcing campaign and raised just enough to get there. It took 3 months of bureaucracy and fortitude to get into Gaza, but eventually I was able to. But by the time I got into Gaza, I had run out of any grant money that I had and had very little other monies coming in. So I was kind of stuck in Gaza. Gaza, just like everybody else. Fortunately, I did have my camera gear with me and was able to earn money working with a number of the nonprofits there, like Oxfam and Mercy Corps, to do videos for them. My time in Gaza was wonderful. I was treated great. I stayed with Atif at his house a good part of the time. A good part of the time I stayed at a bed and breakfast in Gaza called Marna House, which I pray is still standing. Marna House was there long before even the establishment of Israel. It was set up during the British Mandate period. Everybody I met in Gaza, even though they knew I was Jewish, treated me great. I really feel compelled to try to share their story.
Did you meet with members of Hamas? What was your impressions of the government and how honest people could be about their government?
There's many levels to that answer. The first level is, yes, we met and taped with Hamas, and I probably have 2 hours of interviews with Hamas. Very little of it has been shown or seen. Second is that my sense is that Hamas actually exists on 3 very, very distinct levels. There's political Hamas, which runs itself like any political party anywhere, whose mission is to stay as a political party and shape policy. And they are conservative in terms of being Muslim, but they're not ideological extremists. They are very pragmatic as a political organization. Then there is bureaucratic Hamas, which runs Gaza. They run the trash pickup. They run everything needed to run a contemporary cosmopolitan city. And the most important thing when I talk to groups and organizations that I want people to take away is that Gaza is incredibly diverse. There's very, very wealthy people there, landowners. There are people in total abject poverty who have nothing, who rely entirely on the UN for everything. And there are people who in Gaza who are incredibly religious, and a vast majority of the population is secular. So one cannot judge Gaza and the Palestinians living there as a monolithic body. And that goes for the Hamas bureaucratic level, which is the majority of people who identify with being Hamas. They run everything in the government and have nothing to do with the politics. And then there's the third level, which are the militias, which run as a parallel unit, and it's the militias that are doing the fighting now. The relationship between political Hamas and the militias, I can't define entirely. I don't know the relationship exactly between the two. But I do know that some of the young people that I've talked to who are in the militias, to a person, say, we'd rather die fighting than die a slow death. And they said that years ago. And the frustration just kept boiling and boiling. And it was like everybody living inside Gaza was living inside a pressure cooker where the release valve was clogged shut. And so there was no escape from the pressure that they felt every day. And then it blew up. It was inevitable it was going to blow up. And the results are incredibly tragic.
The video footage that you're showing in these short film segments, We All Live in Gaza, The War Chronicles, that video, I'm assuming it's coming from Rami and Atif?
It wasn't until 2 days ago. They were able to uplink on WhatsApp. The footage that I got from them is pretty recent, within the last 4 or 5 days. But as of yesterday, the last email I got saying that they had absolutely no internet connection. And the only thing that they had was data connection, which was running incredibly slow. Plus, they say they have no way now to charge their batteries, because as of maybe yesterday, they still had some fuel, but they indicated that their fuel was going to be gone by today.
So you don't know if at this moment if you'll be able to continue the documentation that you and your team in Gaza are providing.
No, I don't think I can. I sent a message encouraging Rami to keep taping and to see whether he could be in contact with his crew. From what I understand, they still have two or three teams out in the field who are able to get footage to the BBC. Apparently, the BBC still has the ability to get footage out. I think they're using satellite phones, but right now, it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to get me footage.
Tell us where listeners can access the segments that you have been able to produce in the last few weeks.
Right now, they're posted on the project website, which is www.we-gaza.com. But today, I'm going to set up a YouTube channel called We All Live in Gaza, The War Chronicle. So people will be able to go to YouTube, find that channel, and see all the videos. Even though I'm not able to receive footage directly from Rami and the media group, I'm going to try to screen capture other footage, and I'm going to continue to post videos of life in Gaza before the conflict and try to integrate today's footage.
Maurice Jacobson, thank you so very much.
Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.
That was filmmaker Maurice Jacobson speaking to me October 25th about his efforts to report what is taking place in Gaza. If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. My next guest is Yusuf Al-Jamal. He's an editor of the website Politics Today. We spoke October 14th as he was concluding a book tour in the United States, a tour about an anthology of essays, personal narratives, and poetry published last year called Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire. He is one of 12 Palestinian writers whose work is included in that book. He has written articles on topics that include Palestinians in the diaspora, travel restrictions imposed on Palestinians, and struggles for liberation. Yusuf, with the Israeli assault on Gaza underway, I'm sure this is a very difficult time for you. You have friends and family in Gaza. Are you in touch with them? What are you hearing from them?
I have my entire extended family and some of my friends and my neighbors in Gaza, and it's getting increasingly difficult to communicate with them because Israel has decided to completely shut down electricity, fuel, water, and internet services. Bombing is everywhere. Israel has asked people living to the north of the Gaza Valley to evacuate to the south. That's 1.1 million people. And those who chose to move to the south were also targeted. 70 Palestinians from people fleeing the north to the south were killed yesterday as they tried to evacuate. They were bombed by Israel.
Could you share a little of your life story? I know you grew up in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. I understand that 70% of people in Gaza are refugees, many, most from the 1948 war that established the state of Israel. How long has your family lived in the Gaza Strip? Where were they from originally?
Half of my family ended up in the Gaza Strip in 1948. The other half ended up in the West Bank. My mother's side of the family is from the West Bank. My father's side of the family is from Gaza. And they lived in a village called Aqer up until 1948, which was depopulated at gunpoint in 1948. And they became refugees in Gaza and the West Bank. Where I grew up in Gaza actually used to be a British prison from the First World War. And the gate in and out to my refugee community is or was the actual gate of the prison. The refugee camp in Nusayrat is very crowded. We have 120,000 people living there. There are 8 refugee camps in Gaza. And in total, as you said, 70% of Gaza's population are refugees. People have lack of access to clean water. 97% of Gaza's water is unfit for human consumption. We always had struggles with electricity too. We would have electricity shortages. And best case scenario, we would have 8 hours of electricity and then another 8 hours without electricity. This is the norm in Gaza. sometimes it gets worse. 50% of people are below 18. So Gaza has a very young population, but unemployment among young people reaches up to 80%. So people do not find any hopes. We grew up with civilians, inability to move in and out. My mom comes from the West Bank, and it took her 12 years to get an Israeli permit to see her own family. Even when her parents passed away, she was not able to do that. My sister lost her life also because she needed a permit to have a minor surgery, which is not possible to have in Gaza due to the siege and the lack of health infrastructure. So this is our life in Gaza before the escalation. And now with the escalation and Israel declaring war on Gaza and shutting all basic and life support services, such as water and electricity, Gaza is facing yet another catastrophe and mass displacement. And Palestinians in Gaza refuse to be refugees for sometimes the second and third time in their lives. They want to live in peace and dignity and to have equal rights.
Gaza has been under a blockade for 16 years. It's heavily surveilled by Israel. There is very little that happens without Israel knowing of it. I'm wondering what you thought, what you felt when you learned of Hamas's attack on Israel. What was your response? What do you think people's predominant reaction in the Gaza Strip was to this attack that days before most everyone would have thought unimaginable and impossible? And I want to separate my question here. I'm going to ask you later about the carnage that Hamas attack created, but just people's response, your own response to the fact that they were able to get out of the Gaza Strip.
The majority of people were taken by surprise. I have always imagined that because of placing people under siege for 16 years, that people will explode one day. But I never imagined that it would be like a military explosion like this, an invasion. In the past, Palestinians have also taken to the borders and protested peacefully. In 2018, the Great March of Return, Israel's response was also lethal, and they killed almost 300 Palestinians, injured 20,000 Palestinians. Many of these Palestinians lost their legs. So the people of Gaza have been subjected to a huge amount of violence over the years. They have tried everything. They have called on the international community to end this illegal siege, which caused a serious loss of life to our families. Students are not able to leave. They lose their scholarships. Patients are losing their lives. Palestinians cannot have a normal life. I always thought that this is not sustainable. There will come a day when something happened, but I never imagined that it would happen this way.
Hamas staged a daring, devastating, heinous attack October 7th, in which hundreds of Israelis were massacred, more than 1,000. We're now seeing Israel's response. People in Gaza are being deprived of food, water, fuel, electricity. Thousands of people have been wounded, are being wounded by Israeli bombs. Thousands have been displaced from their homes. The health system in Gaza is breaking down. There's not enough space in hospitals to care for all the wounded. Do you think people in the Gaza Strip are blaming Hamas and its attack on Israel for the misery they're experiencing or not? People were living under a harsh and seemingly unending blockade that nobody was doing much to end. What do you think most people in the Gaza Strip are feeling about the Hamas attack? Do you think they're blaming Hamas or simply Israel?
I think people think that the Israeli occupation is the reason that led to the escalation, most recent escalation and previous escalations. This is not the first time Gaza is being subjected to an Israeli campaign of bombing. Even if we go back to the 50s, Israeli forces also attacked Palestinian refugee camps in Khan Yunis and Rafah, killing hundreds of Palestinian refugees. This has always been the norm for Palestinians in Gaza. If we look at the most recent, say, 12, 13 years, in 2008, 2009, 1,500 Palestinians were killed by Israel. And 2012, another like 200 Palestinians. And 2014, 2,200 Palestinians were killed by Israel in 2018, 2021, and now 2,200 Palestinians have also been killed, including 700 children and 300 women. Before this attack, Palestinians were killed, and after this attack, Palestinians are killed. What makes it different is that this time, death and the way Israel is attacking Gaza is unprecedented. They're demolishing entire neighborhoods. They're targeting hospitals. They ask two hospitals to evacuate. They're asking 1.1 million Palestinians to move to the other side of Gaza from the north to the south. They leveled neighborhoods to the ground, including targeting ambulances and medical teams and journalists. Eight journalists were killed in Gaza, and also seven other medics lost their lives. It's unbelievable what's happening in Gaza. This time is a huge catastrophe. And as I said, the majority of people who are being killed in Gaza are civilians, and they're paying the price for this attack. And not just this attack, but for being Palestinian, because they were also killed in the past.
Tell me about this book, Light in Gaza. How did it come about? What you and the other writers hope to achieve with it?
Gaza has always been marginalized when we talk about Palestine. The idea was to imagine and ask people in Gaza, what future do they want to see away from occupation and siege? There are 12 contributors to the book who wrote about different topics, including agriculture, culture, artificial intelligence, architecture, travel restrictions, and Gaza's history. Not just like politics, but also food and culture and music and arts.
You're here to tell Americans about life in Gaza, to educate them about the realities of life there. What do you want them to know?
I don't want Americans to remember Palestinians as victims, Palestinians from Gaza, although we are, but we are also survivors and thrivers despite the occupation, as if we live above the occupation, as Palestinian novelist Ibrahim Nasrallah says. 98.5% of the people of Gaza are literate. There are a lot of people who have master's degrees and PhDs in Gaza. We can contribute to the world if the siege is lifted. It's a political question. It's a man-made humanitarian crisis. It has to come to an end for people to live in dignity and to have equal rights and access to education and healthcare and water. I want Americans to know that people of Gaza are part of the people of Palestine, and 70% of people in Gaza are refugees. So the question of Palestinian refugees has to be addressed for this conflict to end, and that Gaza has a long history and it's diverse, and it has a pagan history, it has a Jewish history, Christian history, and Muslim history. It's one of the oldest cities in the world. There are a lot of things that they shouldn't learn about Gaza other than the conflict, people's habits and food habits, and the fact that they like spices and chili, their sense of humor, just to see Palestinians in Gaza as humans rather than statistics and numbers.
Last question. You've been involved in books about Palestinian prisoners. I know that huge numbers of Palestinians have been imprisoned by Israel at one time or another. Did your involvement with these books come about partly because it is such a big part of the Palestinian experience? Did you have a particular identification with that topic coming from the Gaza Strip? How did your translation of those books come about?
1 million Palestinians have been imprisoned by Israel since 1967. So it's a major issue for Palestinians. Almost every family has someone who was imprisoned by Israel. There are people who are in prison without charge or trial under administrative detention. Some of them spend 15 years in jail without being able to know why. Child prisoners. I translated a book on child prisoners. There are almost 250 Palestinian child prisoners at any given time who are arrested by Israel as young as 6 years old. I tell their stories to the world. Palestinians who go on hunger strike because they are held under administrative detention without charge or trial, and connecting their experiences with other experiences of prisoners in the world, such as in Ireland. The third book that I worked on was Palestinian Irish hunger strikers. I thought these people have stories. And the world should be able to access their point of view. Many of them are placed under solitary confinement or do not have access to healthcare or family visits.
Yusuf Aljamil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Yusuf Aljamil, a journalist from Gaza who now lives in Turkey. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. If you'd like to listen to the full episode, you can check out our podcast or go to our program page on the KKFI website at kkfi.org.